Jody Blake, and I'm curator of the Tobin Collection of Theater Arts here at the McNay. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you and share with you Myrna Colley Lee, costume designer, and to engage in conversation with her this evening about the designs for four productions that you see here on the walls and out in the gallery, and that are part of our current theater arts exhibition at the McNay, Songs of Social Significance. Okay. Myrna, welcome.
Thank you all.
And Myrna and I are going to converse for a while. I'm going to ask her some questions that are on my mind as curator about her career and about her work, and then we will open the conversation up to you towards the end, so please do add your own voices to our conversation. And Myrna, I want to start out with some just sort of general background questions about your journey as a designer, and then I think we'll start talking about the work and perhaps go around the gallery and go sort of production to production, show to show. How does that sound?
Perfect.
That sounds good.
Okay. I don't know if... Just need to hold my head down.
Myrna, I know we have quite a number of theater design students here, so I'm going to actually start out by asking a question on their behalf. How did you become a costume designer?
The easy answer is that I had a roommate who produced a little theater company, and she got me started doing posters and flyers and then sets and scenery, then costumes, and then I decided I'd better go to graduate school and learn to do what I was already doing.
Now, that was in New York City, correct?
Yes.
Okay. But your background, I mean, you were already an artist, but you were a painter.
Painter, scene painter, and teacher, an art teacher in elementary through 12th grade school, public school.
So. But you weren't a native New Yorker, were you?
No.
Where did you grow up?
North Carolina.
Oh, North Carolina.
I'm a southerner.
Were you from an artistic family? Did you come by it naturally, as we said in Tennessee, where I grew up?
Naturally. Sort of. My father was very, very crafty. He was. He liked to invent things and to build things and to build big things. And he was always buying houses and needing them painted and remodeled. And so I was his son. I was his boy because I didn't like the kitchen. I didn't like anything to do with the kitchen.
Well, it would make sense why you thought at first that you primarily wanted to do sets, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I was actually afraid to draw people. I didn't think I could until I got to graduate school in 1976, and we had to take a costume design course, and I had to draw people. And then I discovered that I kind of liked it, that I could do it better than I thought I could. And I didn't like drafting. So set design, I only like to do the fronts. Somebody else has to figure out the backs.
Okay. But what was the theater scene like when you arrived in New York?
Oh, my. Very active, especially black theater. It was a second or third time that there was a renaissance of black theater. The Ford Foundation was very active in giving money to black theater. There were lots of playwrights writing plays, and everybody and his mother had a little theater company. So there was a lot of work, and all of us were learning how to do the technical parts. The writing was better, the acting was better. The technical parts didn't exist much. So it's like filling a gap that was all over the place. And it appealed to me. I never wanted to be an actress.
Okay. Oh, okay. But that was the mid-1970s, more or less?
Well, started about 68.
Oh, really? Okay.
And then went to the mid-1970s before I figured out I should go to graduate school. Okay. Graduate school was the best place to have a whole lot of theater experience in a compressed amount of time, because I hadn't actually even seen a play until I was in New York. As an adult.
Okay.
I had seen Maria Tallchief in Houston in the ballet when I lived in Prairie View, Texas. I lived in Prairie View for a while in high school.
And tell us about graduate school, where you went, who you studied with.
Went to Temple University. Goodness, you'll make me remember all those names. Temple University had a very good graduate program. Neil, what was Neil's last name? Don't remember
That's
Neil's
okay.
last name right
That's
now.
Okay.
He was the costume design teacher. Okay. And I, you know, that was where I first started drawing the costumes and figuring out, oh, I can do this.
Yeah.
And I did sew. I used to make my own clothes, so I was interested in clothing, but hadn't really thought of costume design. Didn't know about costume design. Didn't know what it was, really, until I got involved with theater.
I've been lucky enough to see quite a bit of your graduate student work, and you were not the typical graduate student.
Well, I was already 36 years old.
Yeah. But actually, we have some of your graduate student work on view here. The drawings, the first production to our left, the lion and
the jewel.
Mm-hmm. And as I recall, I mean, you actually chose to do this as a project.
I did. When I went to graduate school, they were doing a lot of the traditional European plays and Greek plays, and I knew I needed a portfolio that had more African-American plays or black plays at the time. And so I made a deal with them that they would let me do one every other play or a little less frequently, depending on what they were doing, because I wanted to have some of the canon in my portfolio too, but I wanted the things that I knew I was going to get jobs in. And so I offered this one first. Because I was going to have the job the following summer at Lincoln Center for a festival of this play. So it gave me a chance to draw it, to acquaint my fellow students with the play. Because the deal was that I would read my plays, they would do theirs, and then I would present my play and tell them what the play was about. So they had a wider experience of theater than the ones that they were reading. So it was a win-win situation for all of us. And I got to do the ones I needed wanted.
Yeah, tell us about the play, if you don't mind, and the playwright, because it's a play from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's
from
a Nigerian playwright named Wole Soyinka, and it's a play where he explores the effect of modern European values on a tribal system and a small tribal group, and the juxtaposition of traditional Yoruba values as opposed to European values. And in this case, the tribal values win out. It's a young woman who's a maiden in the town who the school teacher, who's European trained, wants to marry, but he does not want to do the bride price. And she feels that the bride price is necessary or she's devalued in her society. And so there's this constant tension between him trying to correct her tribal ways and her trying to insist that, no, this is valuable and this is who I am and you're just trying to be cheap. Woo. So then she attracts the attention of the chief of the village, because she has been in a magazine spread. There's a photographer who came through the village, thought she was beautiful, featured her. It was a magazine like Life magazine. And she ends up, in a couple of months, on the cover of the magazine and in a centerfold spread. And the chief ends up near the latrine, down in the bottom in the corner at the end of the article. So to his way of thinking, he should co-opt the prize and keep it for his own, and it elevates his status since she becomes almost more important than he is. So the duel is between the old lion and the young school teacher, who's the modern and the traditional ways. And the broker of the deal is his oldest wife, or his first wife, who usually brokers the deal for the new brides. And she teaches her about the advantage of being the last wife of the old king and therefore the first wife of the new king. And that wins.
Myrna,
a girl with an eye to politics.
Yeah. Tell us about the costume. Myrna actually made this costume all over again for us. because I, yeah, no, just cross. So, I fell in love with this show when I first saw the drawings and with your costumes, which I thought were so fantastic, and what you told me about how they were made, and will you share some of that with us?
Sure. This show had not a very big budget. I think we had about $350 to do the show. It had about 14 characters. A lot of them were villagers who just wore wrapped fabrics. And so we had to, each of us had to volunteer all the African fabrics we had. And I promised not to cut any of it and stitch it up. So we wrapped most of it. And then I bought a fabric that, no, I didn't. Someone had a top that was like this, and a skirt, the whole outfit. And so I borrowed it, but I had to give it back. So then when Jody wanted to do the show, I had to kind of duplicate the drawing that's up in the corner. I have a big collection of fabric, so I found a red one that was similar enough to that, and a piece of fabric that I made the underskirt with, and then covered it with this sheer fabric that's actually Indian. It's a sari scarf, and knotted it so that it gave the same effect of a wrapped skirt and the costume with the little peplum. And then the wig. We drove all over Mississippi trying to find a wig that we could... Well, I wanted an already braided one, thinking it would save the time, but they were in teeny little skinny braids that looked very modern, and it didn't work. So we bought a big curly-haired wig, and my housekeeper braided that thing and beaded it. It took her like 3 or 4 days. And it was good. The necklace, the jewelry, was made by a friend of mine in New York, and that's PVC piping and macrame with beads from the 70s. So that I had the necklace for years. It was in a box. The purse is another friend who had one of those kufi hats that just fit on the skull cap on the back, that we then crocheted the rest of it, turned it into the purse, put some drapery tassels on the bottom, and just pinned it to her waist. feathers, you know, tissue to stuff the peplum out. We just made it happen. But that's the kind of way I would have done it anyway. Because of $350, it's not. You get what you find, and you make it into what you need. Drapery tassels and everything else. We still do that. Everybody does that, even if the budget's $3,000 or $30,000. That's it. The shoes are mine.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for doing that. Myrna, I mean, you're talking about C.D.'s costume. Makes me think of other aspects, which is so characteristic of your work. The research, the working within budget, finding creative solutions, you know, sometimes drawing, sometimes not, sometimes doing collage. Before we talk about the collages, I want to talk about the other show with the drawings, which is The Wedding Band, Alice Childress.
Yes, it was done.
1960s, yeah.
Yeah, it was done in Steppenwolf in Chicago at Steppenwolf Theater. We had a budget.
Yeah.
I think it was maybe $7,000. Mm-hmm. And so we built everything, including the men's suits. The only thing we didn't build was the World War One. Army uniform up in the left, because we could rent those. Okay. They are duplicated a lot. That was a wonderful experience. It was actually my first built show where somebody else built it and not me. I experimented with the technique of drawing the bodies, because I used a very rough textured watercolor paper, but I used colored pencils because I wanted the texture. Because I wanted that rough, not refined texture, because these were not rich people. Even Julia was not rich. She was a seamstress to rich people, and her mate was a baker, a German baker. And he brought her things and bought her things, so she had more than the other women in the place where she lived. But And she would get bits and pieces from what's left over once she was building for other people. So she had bits of lace and interesting buttons and ribbons. And that was a wonderful experience. It was actually my first build show where somebody else built it and not me. I experimented with the technique of drawing the bodies because I used a very rough textured watercolor paper, but I used colored pencils because I wanted the texture, because I wanted that rough, not refined texture, because these were not rich people. Even Julia was not rich. She was a seamstress to rich people, and her mate was a baker, a German baker, and he brought her things and bought her things, so she had more than the other women in the place where she lived. But and she would get bits and pieces from what's left over once she was building for other people. So she had bits of lace and interesting buttons and ribbons. And
You know, again, from a very specific time and place, what, Charleston, South Carolina, 1918. World War I.
The great influenza epidemic, right. That was the whole point of this play.
Yeah. I was going back, refreshing my memory with my notes and remembering what the playwright Alice Childress subtitled it, The Wedding Band, A story of love and hate.
A love and hate, or in black and white.
I forget. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that, sort of flesh out the plot.
The plot
setting.
Is a young woman who's got a more privileged life because she has a big skill. She's a seamstress and does fine work. But she fell in love with a baker, a white man. In South Carolina, that was illegal. Don't know if it's legal yet, but at the time it was illegal, and so she had just moved into this new community, having been kind of chased out of a former community, because every time people would figure out that he was coming to visit her, then she'd have to move to somewhere else. So she was trying to be, you know, private with her life with him. They had been together for 10 years. They always talked about trying to move north and get married, but he had a mother and a sister who were dependent on him, so he couldn't really see himself leaving them, nor could he give up Julia. So they had an anniversary once a year, and he baked a beautiful cake. And the first scene is her in this blue dress, her day dress, that's very nice, and he brings a cake. That photograph is of them and their little sort of courtship, very tender relationship. It's a tragedy because he comes for that anniversary and he's a little feverish. And then in the middle of all of that, he has yellow fever and doesn't get to leave. And so then his mother and sister have to come and get him. He dies there, I think. So they never get to go away and get married, though they were saving up their money and they were talking about it. They would talk about it all the time. So this community was, you know, fearful of her being there, fearful of him being there, but also understanding of the plight. There was another woman in there who was having a hard time getting the army to recognize her status as the legal wife of a soldier so she could get pay, because they had not ever legally married, but she was with him and they had a child. So there was a parallel story going on about one relationship that wasn't accepted because it hadn't had the traditional marriage, another one who couldn't get traditionally married. So melodramatic, fitting of the period, and not often done as a play, though it's pretty topical still.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about that too, because marriage and who has the right to marriage is still
a big topic.
But that play had an evolution. Well, you designed it only once.
Only once, right.
But how did it originate? How were you invited to design it? Had you worked with the director before?
Yes. The director who directed that I'd worked with a couple of times before, and four or five times since. Mm-hmm. So Ron Parsons asked them to hire me, and they did. And so I went to Chicago in February. Dreadful. and lasted and survived.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful experience. The set was really beautiful. It was kind of the backyard of a two-story house with other small one-story kind of shacks behind it. And one of the characters in it owns the house, the lady in the green dress, who has sort of three costume changes, Fanny. And the other people lived back there, and they had basically one skirt and maybe one top with a jacket or an apron that made their costumes vary. And Julia Augustine had three or four costumes, I think three.
Yeah.
Right, they're the three. The wedding dress that she wears for their, she wears after he's dead. She comes out in it, and it's kind of, you know, spaced out and losing it in her dress, which she designed for 10 years earlier, so it's not the same period. It's an earlier period, and because that was when they started talking about getting married, and she dragged out the dress and looked at it all the time, but it never got to happen. It was a sad,
mm-hmm. Yeah, really sad
story. A couple of little girls in it. That's always fun to have kids on stage. Mm-hmm. And they were good. They had to play and wave flags, and, you know, when the soldiers came home, it was a parade. A salesman is in it who comes there and sells them things like stockings and buttons and hair ribbons and, you know, the necessities. And he's actually, other than the baker, he's the only other white man that only other white person that shows up until the mother and the sister come, and they don't want to come. They just kind of have to come and get their relative out of there. That's a pretty hysterical scene. But you don't hate them. You know, you kind of see where they're coming from because it's that period. It's not like they were unusual. But they were nervous and feeling that he shouldn't have been there.
Now, you did not do drawings for the mother and the sister, but collages instead.
Of the period, because those were going to be rented costumes. We didn't have the budget to build all of that, and they showed up for all of 5 minutes, so there was no point to building those costumes. So we sent out a kind of an APB on to a lot of other theater companies and said, do you have anything that looks like these in this size or these measurements? Okay. And we got quite a few things back, and we picked what we wanted and sent the rest back.
But where did the images come from? And are those the kind of images you would have looked at to do? How did you do research for the other characters?
Catalogs, Sears catalogs exist from the period that still have silhouettes of the dresses. Godey's Ladies book, is that the right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of research, mm-hmm. a lot of paintings that you can find primary. They call it primary research mm-hmm. because it's painted directly from the period. You can find it. Mm-hmm. And then online, of course.
Yeah, I was wondering if you...
But that's duplication of original. And I'm not as good online. I buy a lot of books.
That was what I was going to ask you. Yeah, because I had that impression.
I'm getting better, but at that point I wasn't.
Yeah. And, of course, collage is the way you're doing the designs for the other two productions here, for James Baldwin's Amen Corner, and then for the ballad of... Emmett Till.
I do collages when it's a show where I can actually find the costumes, you know, not so old that you can't find clothes from the period. And there's no point in drawing it because you're not going to find what you're drawing. Mm-hmm. You're going to find something suggestive of what you have in mind. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a shopping list. Mm-hmm. I put it together knowing what generally I want the character to be like, the silhouette, the style. And then I go shopping. That was done at the Cleveland Playhouse. They have the biggest warehouse of clothing that exists from every period that anybody who was a patron of the theater gave away. They gave their clothes away, or their children did when they died, or, you know, and the theater accepted all of it. The space that housed that was three times as big as this, maybe five times as big as this, and maybe twice as tall. With ladders and things hanging from the ceiling. It's great. It was a great resource. Still is. And so we would pull and reconfigure or take in or let out or whatever we had to do.
But the collage collages are not just shopping lists. I mean, those are...
Well, especially not for that show.
Tell us about the show, about Baldwin's play, and
I don't know if you know what the Amen Corner is, but it's a preacher, a woman preacher, in a kind of storefront church, or a little bigger than a storefront church, because Baldwin was a child preacher in a storefront church. And he was fascinated by church politics. And this was a woman preacher who led her congregation to believe that she'd been left by her husband, abandoned by her husband, and had a child. He shows up after a Sunday service, and he's ill, and he needs her to take care of him. And a couple of church members bustle down the stairs and discover the scene and get different ideas about her dedication, and that she actually left him because he was a jazz musician and she didn't want that life. She wanted to be in the church. And so she removed herself and her child and abandoned her husband, which didn't sit well with them at all. That couple was brother and sister Boxer, and they were very full of themselves and very powerful in the church, and they wanted to get her dethroned, thrown out. And so that big hat and that Louis Armstrong character is Brother Boxer, because it was, the personalities of each of the people were very strong to me. And when I found my Ebony magazine images, which is where most of those came from, I started playing with scale, so that the hat's big because Brother Boxer's head was big, you know, and his stylish dress. I started enjoying doing the collages. I had lots of time to do that one. Sometimes when it's fast, you don't have a lot of time. You just need your shopping list. But when you have the time, you get to make them into, I guess, sort of artworks. Mm-hmm. You thought so.
Had you actually done collage projects when you were doing your undergraduate art school, or was that all focused on painting?
That was all painting. They wanted us to render. We needed to learn to draw and paint, so we always had to draw everything and paint everything. But they were almost never modern shows. Mm-hmm. It was so we could learn historical research, and we could go to primary sources, and we could learn to render lace, and we could do, mm-hmm. you know, everything that was required of historical research and rendering. So I didn't do any collages in graduate school. It was after. It was as much expedient as it was kind of fun. I always liked collage as an art form, so it kind of suited my purpose and became my signature after a while. That was all I ever did for modern shows. And a lot of black theater is modern, so a lot of playwrights writing since the 50s.
So. And what interests me is it really combines design with research. I mean, in a way, did you share those with, did other people see those, or were those just for you and the costume shop who were going to help you pull down what you needed?
It's for the director and the actors. It helps the actors a lot to see what you think they look like, and you've done research that they may not have had time to do about what they look like. Mm-hmm. And so when they finally see, that's what I'm going to look like, then it helps them a lot. Mm-hmm. So I share that on the first reading with the actors, and you get lots of, okay. Then they slip into the character more. You know, it helps inform them. So they usually appreciate it. Yeah. I've never run into anybody that didn't want to be told what they were going to look like.
Yeah.
Even divas.
Yeah.
Who kind of want to tell you how to do it.
No, there's so much character story. And they're not, I mean, they're the backstory. David, the son, for example, who's mm-hmm. the virtuoso organist playing in his mother's services, but then...
But wants to be a jazz musician and discovers that his father is a jazz musician. Yeah. He thought he was dead.
Yeah.
And so he has an adolescent crisis between mother and father, too, and life, and leaves. It's quite a catharsis for her. She loses the church, but she nurses her husband. And the son, you know, you get the feeling that maybe that riff will get fixed.
And I think there's even something, collage signifies rupture and...
Disjointed and layers.
Yeah,
it is. It's very...
It's very suited to theatrical rendering, or can be.
And I think even to a period when, you know, it was still black and white photography for the most part. I know you and I are old enough that our early photographs are black and white, you know, and we show them to youngsters. I've had that
experience. They don't know what's wrong with it.
And it just signifies something, too. Yeah.
Well, a lot of the old Ebony magazines were black and white.
Yeah, they were.
And a lot of books that I would buy about sections of towns and musicians and whatever else I could find, nurses, religious figures, a lot of black and white photographs.
But even some of the really important, I mean, there's something of Roy de Carava, or I don't know, or do you ever use photographs by well-known photographers for your collages as well as?
I do. Always wondered if it was legal, but I do, because, you know, if you just find the photograph where you find it, and it's not for profit, so I don't know how that works.
The last production, The Ballad of Emmett Till, in addition to having the, well, actually, we took the collages on the wall. We pulled them out of your production book, which is displayed
in the case.
Is that the more natural way for your work to live, actually, in the production books, or do you treat it and frame it like it's an artwork, or is it more process, part of making the production?
The renderings I frame because they've been in exhibits before, and they need them framed. The collages usually stay in the books because I take them to the first rehearsal in the book, and the shop can use them, and they're kind of fragile. You know, that's just glue and paper, and it's rubber cement, which is probably not the best glue to do for archival purposes, but I wasn't ever thinking of it as being something that would last forever. It was working drawings for actors and for the shop.
I mean, that is a production familiar to some people here because we did readings. Vincent Hardy from St. Phillips, who you met today, was just wonderful to do that stage reading with five young actors from San Antonio. How many of you saw that? I know quite a number. So some of you are familiar with The Ballad of Emmett Till. That's a production that really hits quite close to home for you, and I mean that literally, and not just figuratively.
Right, I live in Tallahatchie
County. Remind us about Emmett Till.
Well, in 1955, a young 14-year-old boy came from Chicago to visit his mother's people in Money, Mississippi. And he was a Chicago teenager who could whistle at women and be fun in the street and wasn't, a really unruly young man. He had a kind of a lisp, and he had polio when he was young, so he had a slight limp. Didn't last but a week in Mississippi because he didn't know all the rules. And so he didn't avert his eyes, and he whistled at the lady in the shop. And it got him killed. And his mother decided to show his coffin open because he was very mutilated. And she felt that the world should know what happened to her son. So it made it into a big deal, and then Rosa Parks was so influenced later that she didn't get off a bus because she thought about Emmett. So it's very important and very tragic and hard to deal with. It was a hard play to do. The version I did was 14 characters done at the Goodman Theater. It was almost the opera of Emmett Till. It was just huge. And 2.5 hours and very richly done. And I don't remember what the budget was, but they didn't ever stop doing what we needed to do. But we didn't build a lot. There's a lot of costumes. The 50s is easy to find. Even that dress that's on the mannequin there was made for Mamie Till, copied from a dress that she's wearing in one of the photographs. And the fabric existed, though dry cleaning is making the white dots come away. But we didn't hand paint that fabric. Sometimes that can happen in a theatrical production. That's probably why they let us have it. Most of the times, I don't own the costumes. I own this one because it was my fabric, but everything from that show went back to the people they belonged to. Steppenwolf let me take these. And then I think they finally sold them to Mississippi State University, who houses my collection. And they let it travel. So. And how did we get the Mamie Till, do you know?
We corresponded with Montana. I think Montana made that connection for us.
Okay.
Last year's Tobin intern, those of you who are students or professors, you know we have a 10-month internship for individuals with a master's degree. Okay, advertisement over. But I think Montana.
Okay.
Montana was the one who got that for us. So.
Okay, well, yeah. That's great because it's nice to see that. I was thinking that was during the presidency of Eisenhower.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a dress that looks like Mamie Eisenhower would have worn it. So it was great to work on that. The set was huge and operatic with a lot of corrugated tin. It had a turntable so that action could come on to stage and people could walk backwards. It had a courtroom scene at that point. The version you saw doesn't have much of a courtroom scene anymore because the woman who wrote it decided that it was too big and too heroic and too confusing for people to see the murderers then become the sheriff. So she took it out because you can't have enough characters to people, all of the people. It was had 44 or 45 different characters. And people would just change a hat or put on a vest or and become somebody else in that version of it. I think in the five actor version that just read, it wasn't a whole production, first of all. They still had the script in their hands, right? But I don't think they changed any costume, right? So you just believed who they were, right? Right. So I doubt if the 14-person version will ever get done again. That's very expensive for a theater to do. It was wonderful that the Goodman could afford to do it and that at least it got done once.
Were you involved in the workshopping of the Ballad of Emmett Till at Rights and Reason at
yes.
Brown?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Brown University has a sort of a test program where they playwrights can write and get workshopped so that they can begin to see their work. But Aoife Baeza, the person who wrote this, workshopped all the way through the production at the Goodman. So she was rewriting nightly, and actors were relearning daily. And it was very rewarding. I mean, it was a big deal production. I was glad to be part of it. But the workshop process was very intimate up at Brown, and I would go up and stay for 6 weeks, and students would do it, and she'd get to see what she had written and change her mind and write something else or make it bigger or whatever. It's a great process if you get to be involved in that. And that's where I started developing the collages. So they went on for a long time. There's like 20 pages of research. Beauty queen pageants, because the young woman who was the clerk in the store had been a beauty pageant queen. So just atmosphere, just to give the actress a feel for who she was and why she was angry about being in this little store. Instead of where she felt she ought to be. I didn't. She was dead already. Aoife did. Yeah, the playwright did. When there's a copy of the letter, of a little letter he wrote to a girlfriend he'd met at the county fair, Heloise, right? And that young woman let her, that woman let her copy the letter. And she used it in the play.
We've surveyed some of your work, just four productions from how many decades?
Oh,
three decades? Three decades. Do you think there are any characteristics that are true of all of your work, no matter what the play, whether you're drawing or doing collage?
Well, that fear of portraying character went away in graduate school. And so I put a lot of character in the drawings. If I get photographs of the actors by the time I'm drawing it, then it becomes the actor that's doing it, or as close as I can get to them. Julia Augustine is very much like the young woman that played the part. Mm-hmm. So is Herman.
Herman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For Emmett, I used more images from the period. So I didn't use the actors at all because there were so many of them we didn't know soon enough. And I started the collages early, so I didn't know who they were. Yeah. And they're more archetypes than they are actual people.
Yeah.
Although they were based on real people. But they've become bigger than life because of the mythic size of the story.
Yeah. Well, I also get that sense you're looking at your drawings, and it's reinforced by hearing you talking about actually the characters in the plays.
I like theater. I never was attracted to movies because, first of all, you don't get to do it with any continuity. You do scenes out of sequence, and I like the rehearsal process. I like being at the theater while that's going on, although I don't get to stay, but I come and go 3 or 4 times, and it's just more immediate for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Old school.
Now, I know you don't always design work by black playwrights or work with companies known for black theater. What is some of your other work? What are you involved with now?
Right now I'm designing a play called Good People. It was on Broadway either last year or year before last. And Frances McDormand either was nominated for a Tony or won a Tony for the part of Margaret. It's going to happen at St. Louis Rep in December, a good month to be in St. Louis, about as good as February in Chicago. but I like working there. Last year they did, I knew I was going to forget a name. What was his name?
Walter Mosley.
Walter Mosley, who is usually a mystery writer, wrote a play based on one of his small novellas called The Tempest Tales, but he named the play The Fall of Heaven. And it was pretty fantastic and had all kinds of things like a devil who ends up in modern times dressed like a GQ model. You know, I had to do hair because the young man starts off the scene with dreadlocks and then he ends up with no hair when he goes in front of St. Peter for them to decide whether he was worthy of going to heaven or hell. And then he gets sent back to earth to prove to this angel that he was not supposed to go to hell. The angel gets totally corrupted, marries somebody and has a kid. And the devil comes in to try to help with the case.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. No. Well, I have monopolized your time. Let's let some of the audience.
Okay.
Pause. Okay.
Then a question.
I do.
Okay. You'll be first. Okay. Done? Okay.
You talked about having you were in graduate school, other students working on the canon. Are there any things you design that are plays, as you said, part of the canon?
Were you able to hear everyone hear the question? Rose Glennon was asking about plays that you've designed for the canon, plays that we'd be familiar with today.
She's trying to make me remember things. Let's see. Yes. Let's see. Bus Stop. I think I've done a Bus Stop.
We could have borrowed your designs for Three Penny
Opera. Oh, for Three Penny Opera, right? I did a Three Penny Opera. What else? Do you remember any of them?
Oh,
there are a lot of them. I'm just trying to remember now. It's hard. Yeah, I'm an equal opportunity employee. If you hire me, I'll come do it.
That may be true, but you seem to have a soft spot for black theater. Where did that come from?
Oh, well, that was the generation. I was around, all of my friends were in black theater. They were writing it, they were actors in it, they were, you know, musicians playing in the bands. I married one of those. And so that was the soft spot, was that there was a lot of it happening. And I was involved in a lot of it. So it was what I knew I wanted to enhance the most. So when I went to graduate school, I was about as old as most of the instructors. And so the deal I made was because I knew I could get away with it. And they didn't mind. You know, it hadn't occurred to them. And a lot of the works that I was presenting hadn't been done much, so nobody knew about them. So they couldn't do them as part of a canon. They hadn't seen them, or they weren't on the syllabus. So I kind of interjected new information.
When you design a show, as you did this one from scratch, and the costumes were then built, mm-hmm. at what point do you turn loose of your design and they move into being constructed, and are they made from patterns or are they draped?
Oh, you don't actually turn it loose ever. You send the drawings, they bring you in to talk about what is this and what does that look like and how wide are you really seeing that as opposed to what you think you drew. And then they estimate the yardages, they take you shopping, you buy the fabric with them, you pick out the trim, and then they put it together in muslin and you watch how that fits and you change the waistline according to the body. That, you know, you're never out of the process. So you don't turn it loose. And then sometimes you have to make changes because the actress is not the body type that's going to work for what you did, so you fix it a little bit so that she doesn't draw, or the actor doesn't draw focus for being clownish looking. You don't want that to ever happen. And most actresses won't let that happen anyway. Actors are a little more forgiving. They don't seem to care about clothes. Some.
Yes. I just had my awareness of the importance of costume design substantially elevated. I had never had any idea of the importance of costume design in character creation or the investing of especially with important character, especially with meaningful character traits. And from hearing you talk, it almost sounds like you sort of took over.
No. The play is always serviced by all of the people, all the technical people that are involved. Well, on stage, though, you only have 2 hours, 15 minutes at the most, maybe, to help the audience get into this whole world of these people. And so you really have to enhance the characters with color and texture and everything that the playwright doesn't say, because they're not going to be bothered with telling you what to do to dress them. Sometimes they don't even think about it enough to give you time to get them in or out of it. You know, they want the magic to happen. They wrote it and then 2 seconds later, it's 6 days later and no time to change the clothes. And so you have to get very clever about how to get them in it and out of it, or put it on the stage so they can sneak it on in the dark, or all kinds of things. Whoops.
Yes.
That is so true. I might have Catherine Johnson. I've done some very, very effective playhouse. And I always say, and do you ever find it frustrating that?
Absolutely. Oh, really? I try not to do those. Ben playwrights, August Wilson's notorious. He wrote for theater. His wife was a costume designer, and he can go from one scene to another that's a week apart and didn't even think about it. I don't know how she managed. Because sometimes she would have to costume some of those. You know? And directors get clever and do music. But actors not seeing the costumes until a week before, that's awful. And I've done it to people, you know, because of the budget and the rehearsal time, but most theaters are trying now not to do it that way. Oh, well. If you end up with one union actor, then they won't let that happen. Because they will make sure they get fitting times. That. Well, no. Emmett Till was actually probably the biggest budget, and I think it was $10,000. And a lot of pulled costumes that they owned. So I'm not sure whether we spent it or not. I didn't have to keep up with that part. They have a huge costume shop. No, I don't. I guess that they help me do that, but they make it look like they're not helping me do that. Because I'm sure they have to think about it, but the wardrobe, the costume shop manager is the one who's keeping up with the numbers, and she'll just let me know if I get past it, but or if I'm too near it and I need to make some substitutions, but I don't usually have to think about it. When it's clothing that you buy or that you pull, that's thrift stores and storage that theaters already have. And so you kind of, I come in under budget a lot when that happens. Because if they have stock, then you use the stock. I'm not against using stock at all. And the better the costume shop, the better they are at taking it in, letting it out, adding to it, you know, fluffing it up, fixing it. Whatever we have to do to use it.
So you go in and use your crew already in place?
Yeah. I don't have staff because the individual theaters have the staff. I work mostly in regional theaters, and regional theaters come equipped with all that. So I just go in and do my job, and they assist me, and we get it done, and then I'm gone. And they take care of it. Try working for them.
I think we have time for one more question right here.
I was just going to ask, we have a lovely variety of rendering styles out here, and they're all very different. But I was wondering if there is a certain way that you prefer to work. It's all very evocative, and it fits the play. Do you respond to the play whenever you're rendering?
Almost always. I think watercolor, and you don't, well, these are watercolor. Watercolor on pastel paper, because I didn't want to get involved in skin color. And so I picked the skin color already as the paper, and then except for the king and the wrestler, I didn't have to deal with skin color, just a little shadow here and there to flesh out the body. Watercolor, I guess because I was better at it for a while, but that would always, they would make us try different medium. So after a while, I've liked them all, you know, because you do it, and you do one a week, or one every 2 weeks, and so you're drawing all the time, so you get better and better at drawing, so then you try different mediums, and you get better and better at that, and it's 3 full years, you know, of graduate school.
Like, when you do your collage work, do you also do a rendering for your collages, or is it just...
No, that just grows. Mm-hmm. I cut out and place and play, so it's much more like playing. I like that process a lot, but that's very dependent on research and then enlarging and shrinking and then moving them around and discarding. That almost takes me longer than a rendering. But in some ways, well, not as satisfying, because rendering, you're doing it. I'd like it to fit the play. It's the hidden painter in me.
Good. Well, we could continue, but thank you, Myrna. Thank all of you. And
thank you. Good morning. You want to ask me later?
Okay. Good.
Had one student who had a question. I wanted
okay.
to
oh, okay.
I was curious about the collaboration between you and directors or other designers. As we've talked, it's obviously a very, very strong vision about your project. I know the theater can sometimes be a compromise, and I was curious as to what your experience was and how you establish a collaboration with your directors, actors, and designers.
Directors are very important, and some of them know what they want.
And some don't necessarily know what they want till you show it to them. And then they may not want it, you know, so then you have to go back to the drawing board. So the collaboration is constant during that period, but that's all before the actors see it. So you get to work out all that. Now, the one I'm working with now, we email a lot. I write in words what I feel a character is. Then he writes back and says that he's looking more for this, and then we go back and forth. And then he'll send me the pictures when he's finished casting. And then that becomes very clear what he wants, because what he's chosen will make you know who he thinks that person is, for the most part. Sometimes you'll get an actor that's a total chameleon, so they don't look like that. You know, the headshot is some glamour shot, and that's not at all what they're going to play. So, but it's a lot of communication, and email and telephone is the way you do it now. They can't afford to send for you but three times. Right, and we're all over the world. And so he deals with the set designer differently because they've got to start the whole process. And then we get involved, and the lighting designers last. And so the director and I and the set designer end up talking a bit, and I get pictures of what the set's going to look like so I don't end up putting somebody in the same color as the floor or the couch, you know. And then the lighting designer gets to see what all three of us has done, and he usually is doing that on the live set, on the real set. So they're the ones that don't sleep at all during tech, and we sleep through tech. Because it's like, you know, until somebody can't get something off or put it on fast enough, it's boring. Okay. Paint dry, grass.